Welcome back to the Dealmakers Podcast Show with serial entrepreneur Alejandro Cremades, best-selling author of The Art of Startup Fundraising and co-founder at Panthera Advisors. In this podcast, we ask our guests about their successful acquisitions and financing rounds.
Alrighty, hello everyone and welcome to the Dealmaker Show. So today we have a founder, you know, with a really interesting story. You know, I find that his journey, you're all going to find it pretty inspiring. You know, he basically did a tremendous exit. We can't really disclose numbers, but we're definitely going to be talking about what that journey was. We're going to be talking about product market fit, the emotional journey of a founder, the reality distortion, you know, just like the stuff that you would probably, you know, have heard from Steve Jobs and the likes, and many other stuff about building, scaling, and financing. So without further ado, let's welcome our guest today, Joshua Vola. Welcome to the show.
Thank you very much for having me today.
So originally born in the Netherlands, but you've moved quite a bit. Give us a walk through memory lane. How was life growing up?
Life growing up was actually pretty good. The Netherlands is a nice and pretty open space. I did about 13 years there, and then I moved to Switzerland. Stayed about 10 years there. I did go through the non-English education system there, so the normal education system, which meant I had to learn French and everything that comes with it. So an interesting, tough, but very formative period. And then ultimately moved to London because Geneva was way too boring for me.
So then let's talk about going to London. I mean, you ended up going to London, you know, for studies, and you did computer science, but even before that, you know, you had it in you because you got into the whole thing of coding at about 11. And at the time of 16, you were already making money. So you had it in you to a certain degree. So what do you think got you into computers and then also that bug of building something or selling something?
So the computers was really all about gaming initially. I loved computer games. And so initially, my idea was I wanted to figure out how to build them. And then once I got into actually building stuff, it was the immediacy of the feedback loop that really got me going. Because if I think about what were the first things I built, they were not actually games. They were websites about games, for example. That feedback loop meant that you just, every time you tried something new, you instantly could figure out if it was working or if it wasn't. And if it wasn't, you could try again, execute again, it would never end. And then from the monetary side, I got to the point where it simply was paying more than babysitting. And so I could do what I wanted to do whilst making money and making more money than babysitting. So why would I not do it?
So, I mean, that makes total sense because, I mean, that got you going. And obviously, you have never stopped since then. So I guess in your case, you went to London, you studied computer science. You know, obviously, it was quite the logical thing to do, you know, given the drive that you had in this segment. And then basically right after it, you know, you got started with your first company, which ended up being a pretty good outcome, which is super awesome. So walk us through how the whole thing, you know, came about, you know, with your co-founders.
So I'll start one step back because just before going to London, I had started and dropped out of university twice, once in business management, once in economics, and this was in Geneva. And then when I moved to London, I did computer science mostly because I was scared that someone at some point in my life was going to tell me I couldn't do something because I didn't have a piece of paper. But I didn't learn anything at university. I knew how to build apps. I knew how to build websites. There was very little stuff that I learned there. But it was a fundamental bit of where I am today because I always loved learning and I hated education. And then by the time we started Subrosum, that was actually my fifth company. I had done four failures before that. Well, I mean, failures are depending on how you put them. They were making money, but they didn't stay around for very long. And the way that Super Awesome really came to be was that because I had built those four other companies before, and because I was the catalyst, I was the one who had driven that from the start, I wanted to learn from some other people. So I wanted to have a co-founding team that would drive me, a co-founding team that I would learn from. And that was really the starting point. So I'd say, Dylan, not to put any, like, we had an amazing co-founding team with Lee and Marina and Dylan. And it was just the appeal initially of learning from Dylan, who had both built and sold two companies before, was the main thing that I was interested in when we started Super Awesome. And the reality is it was mostly his idea to start.
So then let's talk about what were the early days and getting that nice product market fit, because I know that's a domain that that you like as well.
Yeah, so this is actually an interesting one when I contrasted with where we are now. So everyone has this different definition of product market fit, and it's kind of a magical territory that no one has a clear definition from. Some people say, like, you don't have, if you have product market fit, you know it, and otherwise you don't have it. What I can say is that on the inside at Super Awesome, it never felt like we had true product market fit. The numbers were pointing up constantly, but it felt like a constant battle over 8 years of month after month, hitting numbers after numbers and trying to grow. And it was just, it was a tough journey. There was no point during those 8 years where I would say things suddenly got easier because we hit product market fit. And I have the opposite almost within Mindstone. So that what we are doing now with Mindstone, for example, is we are, it feels that we are much more running down a hill, but it's still not anywhere easier. It's just different types of problems. And that's something that I've only recently got to experience, because now I feel that I understand what the concept is, but actually as a founder, it's just as tough, if not tougher, once you have it than if you don't have it.
So then let's talk about then, you know, like, at what point do you guys really realize that you were turning a corner here?
So it's Super Awesome. It was when Edward Snowden and GDPR happened at approximately within the same 2 year time window. So it, up until that point, everyone could agree that a safer internet for kids was a great thing and everyone should want that. But very few people would allocate real money towards making sure that would happen. When you had the privacy scandals with Edward Snowden and the CIA and all of the American scandals of data leakage and spying that happened. And then at the same time, you had GDPR in Europe that started to put really strong privacy requirements on the internet, which had a specific carve out for kids. Suddenly, all of the technology that we had built up, for 5 years, everyone in the world was now paying attention to. Before, everyone was interested in it. Now everyone was allocating budget towards it. And so that was the turning point where really everything started exploding.
So also, how did you guys go about capitalizing the business? Because, I mean, prior to the transaction, you guys did raise, you know, about $36 million. So how was that journey too of raising the money all along the way?
So it was mostly Dylan, my co-founder, and this was one of the greatest strengths of our team. I was responsible for everything product and technology. Lee was heading sales. Marina was heading operations. Dylan was CEO and making sure that we had enough money in the bank. And we each really trusted each other really strongly around that. Now, Dylan had had two successful exits before. So the initial seed money came from him. Then the initial backers came from his contacts. And then we had an interesting journey because our Series B was through private equity, which you would not have expected normally. Basically, this was the period where private equity was going earlier and earlier in the journey because there were not that many great private equity deals going around at the time. And so we ended up with being really interesting to them. And they were great partners as we scaled. This was Mayfair Equity who backed us then. And that was they were the most significant backers of Super Awesome.
And now you were doing your MBA at the same time, which is pretty amazing. How were you able to kind of like put both in parallel?
So this was actually one of the better decisions. This was the only learning experience I genuinely enjoyed and think I really got a lot out of. So I did my MBA mostly remotely. And I would wake up at 6, I would go through the theory between 6 and 8, I'd have breakfast and then get to the office by 9, and I would try to apply whatever I would have learned that morning as we were scaling the company. 9 times out of 10, it would work terribly. And like everything that I thought I had just learned at the theoretical front just didn't pan out. But 1 time out of 10, something actually worked. And so I do credit having gone through that feedback loop with a lot of the learning that I went through.
So then, in terms of the for the business too, I mean, how did the whole approach to of getting started with investing, you know, happen? Because I mean, it's like so many things happen with you at the same time, you know, during this time we do super awesome. I mean, not only building the business, but doing the MBA, getting your feet wet on making investments in other startups too. So, what sparked the interest too on investing in other startups?
So I was thinking, I've always loved learning. And so when I finished my MBA, I was trying to figure out what is my next learning journey. I like the idea of parallel where I'm learning theoretically whilst building. And I then looked at the numbers and I thought, okay, well, what are various ways that I can accelerate what my next learning path could be? And I could do a master's in AI, and I was thinking about that. But the investment ecosystem in the UK is built in such a way that early stage investment is actually a really appealing financial decision. And so I ended up with a calculation where I thought, well, if I invest 10, 20, 30,000 pounds a year with all the tax incentives that were in place in the UK, that ended up being less expensive than paying for another degree. And so I thought, well, if I just invest over 3 years and I take all the learnings from the bad investments I do, the good investments I do, I take the new connections that come out of this, that learning is probably worth more than any master's that I could go through. And so I considered it a learning experience in the first few years, and it definitely paid off in my case.
So I guess, say, what were you, for example, like on startups, you know, what were you looking for, you know, and then also how did you apply those lessons learned to your own case?
So I really went around it from a learning perspective. So initially I got involved with an early stage fund and I thought, okay, well, let's learn from how a professional investor invests. Then as I got more exposure to deal flow from that early stage fund, I started to look at what their various investment theses were for different companies they invested in. And then when I got to make my, when some of the other founders that I knew came to me for investment, at some point I then bit the bullet and thought, okay, well, this one seems interesting. I have a little bit more cash that I can invest now. And I started doing it myself. Where it really started to come back was that by the time I started my next company, Mindstone, I had built out a pretty extensive investment network of other investors, because as I was trying to figure out how to be a better investor, I was talking to other investors about this. And now when I was talking about financing, I was no longer talking about financing as a one-way street, where it was me, the founder, wanting money from you, the investor. It was, okay, we are both investors here. Yes, I am running my startup, and I'll put my own money in it. But let me talk to you about why I think this is also an interesting investing opportunity. And because I was evaluating investment opportunities on the other side, I was able to position the investment opportunity in ways that I probably never would have thought about had I not been on the other side of the table that much.
Hey guys, so pardon the interruption here. So I got to tell you that, you know, for those of you that are either looking to raise money or you're looking to get your company acquired, you don't have to be alone. You know, there's a lot of psychology that needs to be blended with strategy, with methodology, with process. And it's very hard, and already doing your business alone is super, super difficult. So I remember, you know, back then when I was an entrepreneur, I kept really experiencing the challenge of either knowing or finding the right type of access to the right type of investors, or really understanding what was the right type of guidance, you know, that would carry me through the process, whether it was with seeking money or with going through the acquisition. So that gap that I found being an entrepreneur is ultimately what pushed me later on, when I met my co-founder at Pantera, Mike Severson, to really put together an advisory firm where we are guiding entrepreneurs and founding teams through the capital raising efforts, whether you are at a seed stage or at a Series A stage, or if you are going through the process of an acquisition and you are in small to mid-cap type of a cycle. So again, you know, we would help you from guiding you and supporting you from A to C all the way to the end as an extension of your team. And there's no reason for you to do this alone. So with that being said, if you would like to find out more, feel free to send me an email at alejandro@panteraadvisors.com. And we would love to take a look at helping you out.
So I guess talking about the cycles here of a company, I mean, in this case, you know, with Super Awesome, you guys ended up going through an acquisition. You know, what was that process like?
It was very interesting, tumultuous, but it was about whatever, nine months, 10 months from the moment that the initial intent was expressed to the moment we actually closed. There were multiple times in the middle of the deal where we thought it was going to happen, and then the next day it was not. People that started to make pretty fundamental life decisions within those periods, which is really hard not to do because you very easily start running away from yourself when you see big numbers being thrown around. And they're all life-changing numbers. It's very hard to not let it affect your decision-making, even if none of it is real yet. So yeah, very interesting journey, a pretty tough one, but I mean, it was 10 months. So 10 months of toughness is totally fair in an 8-year long journey. I mean, that were also, but that was, yeah, that was pretty good.
And, you know, obviously going with the ups and downs of one day it's happening, another day it's not happening. I mean, that's pretty much the emotional journey too that a founder needs to endure. So what's your take, you know, from this whole emotional journey that you can also share with the founders listening?
Fundamentally, I believe that grit wins over talent almost every single time. And I'm a big believer in that many sports, elite sportsmen believe in this as well, which is the saying that victory or success is going from failure to failure without loss of enthusiasm. The idea that if I keep getting up, you can't kill me. Or the idea that if you stay around long enough, you will eventually be right. And I think those are extremely true stories. Like a startup doesn't die unless a founder gives up. And that is an emotional journey that people talk about, but there's a massive disconnect between how people talk about it and what the reality of that means. It means that during Super Awesome, which was an extremely big success, there were 8 or 9 times that I nearly quit. I was very lucky that I had a system around me. My wife was very supportive. And every time that I was close to it, someone somewhere told me, don't be stupid. Like, you know, you're going to regret it if you don't. Sometimes there was something else. Sometimes it's the tiniest messages. Like I was getting close to quitting. And then you get a small message of reinforcement from a colleague or from an investor or from another co-founder. And the fragility of your emotional state as a founder when all your net worth, all your life's work is tied up into this one unit you built. And that unit is so volatile that one day you think is going to change the world and the other day you think it's going to disappear. That is a really tough thing to put all your hopes on, basically.
And then how do you put that in parallel too with the reality distortion, you know, which is something that Steve Jobs had, you know, having fun along the way?
I'd say those are two slightly different things, the having fun along the way. The having fun along the way is an extremely important bit because of the fact that it is so volatile and because of the fact that actually the exit itself doesn't really provide that much of it's joy for a little bit and then you have to continue your life. The reality distortion field is that you have to believe something to be true that the majority of the world does not believe to be true. This was Scott Belsky, actually. He said, if you believe something, or if everybody tells you you are wrong, you are either wrong or about to change the world. And that is exactly the thing, which is that as a founder, you have to believe that you know something, even though everybody else tells you that it is not true. If everybody else thought it was true, then everybody would be doing it, which would mean that it was no longer an actual opportunity. So the opportunity is exactly in that spot where the entire world pushes against you. And that is, in my opinion, that's what this reality distortion field is about, which is that you have to believe that you are somehow the exception and that you are going to make something happen. And to everybody else, it appears as if you are magically making it happen. But it's really just extreme persistence and extreme, to some degree, extreme positivity. Because if you let too much of that negativity come in, then the emotional journey becomes unbearable to begin with.
So then, as the saying goes, once an entrepreneur, always an entrepreneur. And in your case, you know, like the next stop was a milestone. I mean, as you were saying, you know, earlier, you got involved with Emerge, you know, then as a result of that, you know, you really got the excitement about this space. I mean, you never, you know, loved the education, you know, side of things as much. You know, now, you know, you're loving it, you know, especially when you get the chance to innovate too. So how did the whole idea of Mindstone, you know, come together? And obviously, you know, you were now a second time founder, so you had been around the block. So why was this problem meaningful enough for you to resolve?
So, I mean, one, I always loved learning, actually. I just hated education. I hated the education system, but learning itself, I really enjoy. The main question for me is just that I am not a person to sit on a beach. I'm not a person to not do much. At the end of the day, as much as I hurt, or as much as it's hard to build a business, for me, it's harder not to have an impact. And so I have a hard time being in a much, much bigger machine, for example, where you might have a smaller impact. And I was thinking, okay, well, if I have another 30, 40, 50 years on this planet, how can I spend that time in the most impactful way? Where do I think I can have the best possible impact? And because I had such a checkered past with education, and because I am an engineer by background, and the education or the learning experience and with technology is terrible, I would say, I thought this is an area that I can really make a difference in. And if we make a difference, I think that education is probably the most impactful space in the world. If you can help people learn better, acquire new skills better, then the ripple effects of what you are building are so big that they have a real effect on humanity as a whole versus a small segment of it.
So then talk to us about Mindstone. What are you guys doing at Mindstone?
So right now we are bridging the gap between the potential that AI has to offer and the 10 to 40% productivity increase that people keep talking about for employees across the business. So we built the biggest practical AI community in the world. And we combine it with a best-in-class, fully personalized technology platform that runs people through how this technology can be used on a daily basis in their respective jobs today to actually be more productive.
So then in this case, I mean, how did you guys go about building the business too? Because I know that you guys have raised some money as well. But I guess before we even get there, how do you guys monetize here? How do you guys make money?
So we run an AI mastery program, which is 9 hours in total. So it really only focuses on the practical bit. It can be delivered over 3 months or 3 weeks. And we work with companies, and specifically all the employees in the companies, to help upskill everyone in the company and make sure that they are prepared and able to leverage all the benefits that come from all the AI tools that are currently being developed all around us. And so companies pay us to use our platform to upskill their employees.
So then what about the capital raising? You know, how was that for you guys?
Dramatically easier this time around than last time, for sure. As a second-time founder, it is definitely easier to make the point that you know how to build a business, and people are more willing to trust you with that. We had a mixture of really great kind of risk or early stage risk capital, Moonfire Ventures, who were the first backers of Mindstone, and also some strategic capital from Pearson Ventures and Zenny Kelly Venture, who obviously Pearson being the biggest education group in the world. And now we have to run and execute. But I think we're at exactly the right time with exactly the right product. And I think upskilling has never been more important than it is today, because it's the number one or number two element on every CEO's priority list at the moment.
So let's say if you were to go to sleep tonight and you wake up in a world where the vision of Mindstone is fully realized, what does that world look like?
That is a very good question. The way we talk about it is that we unlock the potential of humanity by bringing personal and professional growth to every individual. And so the way that materializes is that if you ask people where they go to learn something new, to learn a new skill, today you will get 100 different answers. Some people will answer Harvard, Stanford, a university, Coursera, Udemy, whatever the starting point is, but you'll get 100 different answers. There is no Google or Amazon or Apple of education. There is no one destination where you start to build that new skill. That is what Mindstone will be.
So then obviously we're talking about here about the future. We're talking about vision. I want to talk about the past, but doing so with a lens of reflection. So let's say I was to put you into a time machine and I bring you back in time, you know, maybe to that moment where you were coming out of school, you know, let's say 2013, you know, where you were coming out. And let's say you have the opportunity of seeing your younger self, you know, maybe that younger self that, you know, was coming out in one of those, I mean, maybe graduating out of King's College, you know, and you're able to stop that younger self coming out of school and you're able to give that younger self one piece of advice for launching a company. What would that be and why, given what you know now?
I would have told myself to enjoy the journey more than I did. I have become better over time at taking the roller coaster, but the downs hit me pretty hard and the ups also hit me pretty hard. And that made me less effective. So I should have been slightly more moderated on both ends of that spectrum.
I love it. So Joshua, for the people that are listening that would love to reach out and say hi, what is the best way for them to do so?
So I am both on LinkedIn and on X. So Joshua Vola, can reach me there.
Amazing. Well, easy enough. Well, hey, Joshua, thank you so much for being on the Dealmaker Show today. It has been an honor to have you with us.
Thank you very much for having me. Really enjoyed it.
If you like the show, make sure that you hit that subscribe button. If you could leave a review as well, that would be fantastic. And if you got any value, either from this episode or from the show itself, share it with a friend. Perhaps they also appreciate it. So also remember that if you need any help, whether it is with your fundraising efforts or with selling your business, you can reach me at alejandro@pantheraadvisors.com.
You've reached the end of another episode of the Dealmakers podcast. For free resources and materials, head over to alejandrocremades.com. Thank you for listening and see you at the next episode.